say requesting the changes that were suggested by you over the past few meetings. Page one was, suggestion by Dan Hickey to define murder to specifically include line eight, compelling or inducing another person to commit suicide to the rest of the section. The previous draft was kind of quite ambiguous, but that was covered. So that's beyond. On page two, line 19, the amendment, that was that burglary with the underlying crime for felony murder, and that was redrafted exactly the way it was again provided you with language. Serious on page three, the same amendment, serious provocation was redefined to take care of the situation of an intoxicated person, someone thirsty. And there was one change here that I don't know if it's discussed before you, but it came up under when Dan and I were reviewing it, and that refers to lines 4 and 5 on page 3. I guess we have to read in context with page 2, line 23, all the way to line 5, page 3. What this deals with is a situation where there's an unreasonable belief as to self-defense or other types of justification. And as originally drafted in the committee substitute that put open the house, it provided that if you unreasonably believe that the killing was necessary because you are under duress, that would mitigate what would normally be a murder of manslaughter. And in discussing this with Mr. Hickey, we thought that it was a policy issue that probably wasn't considered at all by the House Judiciary Committee. The question is, should an unreasonable belief as to the rest constitute a defense in murder? We provide in the code that if you reasonably believe you are under duress, it would be a defense in murder. In other words, someone's pointing the gun at you and says, kill someone else. And there's a reasonable belief that you would be killed unless you commit murder. And we provide that to defend. The question is, what happens if it's unreasonable belief? And I think Mr. Hickey and I both agree that that should not be a defense to murder, and that's what the amendment requests. On page 4, the only change here is on line 12 and 13. Well, specifically on line 12, where we provided that the defendant has to be 16 years of age or older in order to be guilty of the offense of engaging in sexual penetration with a person under 13. Well, on page 5, as originally drafted, the crime of sexual assault in the third degree under subsection A1, which was the mental disease or disorder situation, was classified as a B felony. Mr. Hickey suggested in the amendment to you that he made a C felony, and this requests that change. This is the crime of sexual abuse of a minor. And in the original bill, in the committee substitute, there was a an additional subsection there. In the committee substitute, it was on page 15, person 19 years of age or older engaged in sexual contact with a person under 16 but under 13. And if the offense is classified and committed substitute, if it's a felony if it's done under A1 of the section, or a misdemeanor if it's done under A2 of the section, we have deleted subsection 2 from that provision. And the intent is to treat it separately as contributing, and we have a separate amendment to contributing when we get to it. In other words, not to treat that kind of conduct as a sexual offense, treat it rather as contributing. And in doing so, we just have a single penalty provision for the offense, which is C-felony. When we move to contributing to the delinquency, we just treat that as an amendment. Before we That's correct. The first degree is without consent. Under this offense, it does not matter whether it's with consent or without consent. It's simply the fact that the person was under the yes, this is the exact. Okay. Page 7, this is the spousal immunity provision. And we have added a section dealing with spousal immunity, and it essentially says that there is spousal immunity unless one of the three factors exists. Number one, the spousal living apart. Number two, the victim was placed in fear of imminent serious physical injury. Or number three, the defendant caused physical injury to the spouse. Physical injury is defined in the general definition section of the bill on page 99 is physical pain or impairment of physical condition. That is correct. You would have to establish, though, as an element that there was physical injury to the defendant. It does require that physical injury was caused, and that would have to be required to be unreasonable and be without a family. That's correct. Under subsection 2, there would not have to be any injury. If the situation would be, I guess if you have in mind, is a gun or the husband with and if you could prove, you could establish that we know about I would think so.
committee.
The other one, you have to prove that they're actually struck. The second one, you just have to prove that they were threatened that day. I think they're fine on the way down. I don't want to vote down, I want to talk to others. Well, because the thing is, there's three of them, there's two other members, I don't want to have you come back later with two other members of the same thing.
Page eight does reflect one amendment that the independent did send over. And the only addition here is on... Yeah, this is the only one. I forgot, he did send one amendment over. Yes, that's correct. It came over, I believe, on Tuesday. Yes, that's correct. The only addition here, and I apologize, and I have the numbers on the side, is left through this line, and it says each party to any of the acts in the bond of special penetration is considered to be engaged in special penetration. This is in response to a letter that Senator Zegar showed me from Andrew Klonfeld regarding...
Yeah, right,
Regarding...
Let's not go into any more detail, I guess.
Yes, I did, and I should speak to you about that, because it's about another bill, but it's not about the cemetery. Thank you for reminding me. Let me point out that we have not reached agreement yet on kidnapping, so we don't have any amendments on that, just because we haven't been able to work it out yet. It's not that we're disagreeing, we just haven't come up with the staff, right, what have you. So, moving to theft, and this is on page 17, there's a long slide here, it's really on page 18, the committee substitute. All we have done is added to the consolidated theft statute, the failure to make required disposition of funds received or held, and the IPC are acceptable.
That's to cover white collar theft.
Yes. Yes, on page 10, this is also another technical one. In the bill as drafted, we have 3 degrees theft, but one of the degrees is really broken into two sections for penalty purposes. Rather than to do that, it Dan felt might present some problems, we separated it. And you now have 4 degrees of theft, with the first degree being over $25,000. It's not a, it's not a substantive change, it's just merely a technical change. And it goes to the, for purposes of the substitute, on page 18, line 22 to 25, you see that in the committee substitute, that theft in the first degree of the Class C felony on which the value of property or services is $25,000 or more, in which case theft in the first degree of the Class C felony. And Dan felt that might present some problems in proof. So rather than do that, we just made an extra theft.
We got a little one more time.
Yeah, page 11 is another very technical amendment, and it goes to page 19 of the bill, line 17. It just takes out the language, but it's not necessarily limited to. We just simply say it's using the section reasonable measures include notifying the identified owner, because we define include in the general definition, which means include, but it's not necessarily limited to. Page 12 changes the word ordinary person to reasonable person. On page 20 of the committee substitute, line 1.
Okay, can I go back to 19? What's the
That's a good question, Senator. thing is graduating.
Yeah, sure, but I mean, you know, do you have that in Webster?
I think it does in terms of, I don't know if we have it in Webster or not, but
yeah, I mean, puffing up is to swell someone's ego.
Page 13 of that section on certified failure to make the part of the position of funds receiver held, this addresses the question that Senator Weaver brought up. And on line 13 of the amendment, the term recklessly was deleted and the intent to be a strict liability, just mere failure to make the payment sufficient. We've also taken out the specific penalty provision that is now covered as solid debt. In addition, we just renumbered extortion because we had to move around a couple of steps. Okay. This amendment on page 14 on line 14. Well, I'm sorry, the amendment, it changes on line 14 of the amendment, it changes what used to say reasonable grounds to believe, we now say probable cause to believe, and we deleted the definition of what reasonable grounds include. The bad check statute, which on page 25 is pretty substitute, and this reflects two things. It's number one, that on line 6 of the amendment, we've added the exclusion, we've placed the exclusion on post-dating the promissory note from the definition of debt. And in addition, the penalty structure now is based on the value, on the face amount of the debt. There was a typo on this, and we just simply left out subsection 3, which is the definition of issue, but it didn't change. I just left it out of the amendment. Okay. Page 20, this is the statute on obtaining a credit card by fraudulent means. What we've done here is under subsection or A1 or A2, the penalty will be a two felony, and the false statement on the application stays in this. No, this is the one where you make a false statement in an application for a credit card. Okay, this is a response to Senator Killian's point on the burglary statute. We changed the term deadly weapon to a firearm. That's correct.
Yeah, because those were already covered.
Page 18 is the breaking into the cabin defense, and all we've done here is we've made an affirmative defense in the bill was a regular defense. This requires, it now requires the defendant to establish it by the time. This was a section that Dan was going to bring up, and I basically made a applied to him, and he did not bring it up. And we discussed it over the last couple of days. And this is dealt with a situation where the person burns his own house down for purposes of just for construction purposes. I'm sorry, because it's simply the easiest way to get rid of it, maybe to keep it. Under the bill of draft, it was provided that it was a defense to the charge. Dan suggested, and I think I do agree, that it should be an affirmative defense. In other words, that person should
know that he didn't have any insurance on the bill.
Yes, and it's really a substantial proof problem, and need further discussion with Dan. Yes, this, I believe, Senator Ziegler really brought this one up. This is the arson in the third degree, where you start a fire, cause physical injury to a person, and it's been deleted because the seed is installed. It's not, you don't need special presence of the arson. Yeah. Yes, this is the joyriding airplane. And what this amendment does is, number one, it deletes the offense of unauthorized occupancy of a propelled vehicle, and also the offense that you happen to be in a propelled vehicle. On page 21, lines 10 and 11, we have the section on tampering with an oil or gas pipeline or supporting facility, and in response to Senator Holman's point, we added airplane or helicopter within the coverage. So if you tamper with a pipeline, an airplane, or a helicopter with reckless disregard, I don't think it's going to be a lot of problems, but it should say further risk of harm to or loss to the property. It's an automatic speed on it. The other amendments on here reflect the joyriding provision, which we have moved into the criminal mischief. And the first one is on line 16, which is driving, towing away, or taking a propelled vehicle of another and causing damage to the vehicle in an amount of $500 or more, or causing the owner to incur reasonable expenses of $500 or more as a result of the loss of use of the vehicle. And in other words, joy riding becomes a felony when a person suffers $500 in loss as a result of damage, or $500 in reasonable expenses, saving the car, or leaving the car for that period. What we've also done is on line 26 and 27 of the amendment, we really have the main offense of joyriding, which is simply driving, towing away, or taking a propelled vehicle of another without the aggravating factors, and that's an A misdemeanor. Now, on line 28 of the amendment, the last line, page 21, we have a situation where it's the rental agreement and you fail to return it. That's been classified as an A misdemeanor. What we haven't included here is a situation of the garage mechanic who takes the car, you know, you bring
our car out.
And the reason being is we have concluded that this is already covered in the joyriding statute. He can be taking or driving a propelled vehicle without the consent of the owner. In other words, you don't need to set the coverage of it, it's already treated. In addition, the final change is the situation where the person happens to ride in the vehicle knowing that it's been stolen. And in the bill, it was classified as an A misdemeanor. In discussing it between Dan and I think you may have commented that too, that may be too high of a classification. Simply being in the vehicle, knowing it was stolen, it may be an A misdemeanor, may be too high. We classified it as a B misdemeanor. And it requires that you knew it was stolen. And it's important to note that our definition of knowing does include situations where you were aware of a substantial probability that it was stolen. So it's similar to a reckless type of standard. So those are the changes. And then on page 22, we just deleted the joyriding section. So it's all pleaded now as criminal mischief. litterer, and we've eliminated reckless from the definition of littering, and simply placing it throwing. Yes, this is the forgery statute, where it's first degree forgery, and based on the discussions, it's reclassified as a first degree felony. We do have one question we'd like to ask, because we didn't really know how to resolve it. Under the way the forgery statute is drafted, if a person forges a check, regardless of the value, it is going to be a B felony. And the question is, do you want it to be a B felony? Do you want it to create a separate offense and make it a C felony, or do you want it to be simply a misdemeanor? We've left it alone as a B felony.
He forged a check.
Yes. Now, we could say he forged the check over $500, or we could simply say there's a number of alternatives. The problem is, though, is that covered in the first degree section are negotiable instruments, and that could be anything, you know, from a $2 check to a $100,000 check or some other note. So there is a potential, you know, there's a fairly harsh penalty, and we can't. No, we don't have it now, but it's easy to deal with. Okay. The next page is offering a false instrument for recording. It was classified as an A misdemeanor. Yes. This is the next page seems to be broad. And what we have done here, and Dan and I both reached an agreement on this, we originally had 2 degrees of scheme to defraud. We have felt that 1 degree is necessary, only 1 degree is necessary, and we've redefined the crime. Previously, it had to be a scheme to defraud 10 or more persons. We redefined it as 5 or more persons. The problem of what about if there's a single person involved, we have dealt with in line 11 and 12 of the amendment by saying engaging in conduct constituting a scheme to obtain $10,000 or more from one or more persons to constitute a scheme to defraud. So we're talking about fairly large-scale schemes, I mean, large-scale white-collar fraud, and Dan and I have seen that. I'm not too sure you're not. I'd have to do research on that, but I think that that under the federal mail fraud statute, that scam letters would be covered by this. I'd have to. It's simply that if you can't prove one of these aggravated factors, you've defeated a theft or attempted theft.
Thank you.
qualifying business record reclassified as a chief felony from an A misdemeanor.
Yeah, I need to read on that.
This next page on page 28 and 29, this is something that it didn't come up as a problem, but in discussion between Gary and I, we had originally drafted, we had three separate crimes, defrauding judgment creditors, defrauding secured creditors, and defrauding insolvency. What we have done is we haven't changed any of the provisions, we've just consolidated those three crimes to one, with no changes other than it's one crime now as opposed to three. Most of these, I believe virtually everyone is taken from existing law. It's page 45. First crime is endangering the welfare of a minor, and this is basically the child abandonment statute. Drafted very narrowly. You have to be a parent, guardian, or other person charged with the care of a child under 10, and intentionally desert the child under circumstances creating a substantial risk of physical injury in the country's felony. Criminal non-support is based on the existing non-support statute, but it only applies to support of children. It doesn't apply to support of spouses. The next crime is failure to permit visitation to the minor. And Dan has a suggestion on this. This was passed by the legislature last year. We've included in the code without change, other than we had to make a few changes just to conform with the vocabulary in the code. I know Dan feels it's not a proper area for the including the criminal code.
I do. I agree with what I'm doing. I'm down the road with my day. But he was real adamant about it last year for that child support legislation. I would count you called the third one that didn't do great damage to the child support, but evidently he had some trouble with parents who just arranged so that there was never any chance of visitation.
I raised it strictly a policy question that I think the committee should address in the context of the revision of the code, whether the conduct of this nature should be included in the criminal law and addressed by the criminal law. It seems to me that really what we're talking about here is intent. It's a violation of the court order. And it's basically civil contempt. Because, in other words, it's a situation where someone is refusing to comply with a court order where they hold the power to do so. And dealing with it in this way may interfere with the court's ability to deal with it in a contempt situation. I'm not sure what will happen there.
The reason that it came in, as you pointed out, is you get contempt of court, you say, yes, then I pay the lawyer bill. If you make it a crime, you just report it. Somebody else goes and
the issue there is whether it's appropriate for the taxpayers as a whole to be sustaining the costs of some kind of a legal proceeding.
Again, it's not public money, we're all kind of caught up.
All right, I'm not gonna fight to get in there with those ideas, but I'm not gonna vote to take it out either. If it was an awkward one, but we had to discuss last year on a compromise. I feel kind of like I'm doubling back on my agreement to back off of it, because I got the child support forfeiture statute through by buying that. Remember, I didn't want to amend it.
Mr. Chairman, in the subcommittee, we did adopt a policy that there was a recent change in the legislature. We didn't feel prudent by the legislature. And that's what happened here. And I don't think the subcommittee
I don't think it's fire.
This is page 46 of the bill. What, Dan got the problem with it.
Page 46?
Yeah. Page 46 of the bill, and it's beginning on line 1, section 125, to create the offense of failure to commit visitation to minors. And basically, the language describes the offense in a way that where someone violates an order as a result of it. You can have a law proceeding. Your sensitive rights are standard, and if somehow not comply with it, it makes it a violation, which I think is probably lower than what it is present.
Even though you have to not say that you want to, you don't have that kind of good thing to tell you about it, you know, you don't have to say it's wrong. Thank you.
Gets me out of an embarrassment.
I disagree with the rule of law.
I owe you a lot more than that, but I think we break you.
Mr. Chairman, for the next statute, the contributing provision, we have already drafted an amendment to it because one of the changes we made in the sexual assault provision
had to be covered.
Yeah.
And in addition, I believe
Dan has suggested that there was another problem with the statute that's reflected in here. And what we've done here is originally drafted, there was no requirement that the defendant be any age. So you could have a situation where a 12-year-old could contribute to the delinquency of a 17-year-old, theoretically.
Yeah, not when you have an 18-year-old contributing to a 17-year-old.
What we've done is we require the defendant to be 19 years of age or older, and the only other change in this is that on line 13 through 14, we've added a sexual contact situation, which wasn't in the original bill.
Bush's lab, we'll say, a place to bridge for money. Would that be within the definition, like a tenth of a penny or point? Would that be within the purview of gambling?
Play it in both holes or with something?
Well, as drafted now, I believe it would. We could draft it so that you could allow social gambling in this situation. We have defined, the way we've done it is we said gambling, and gambling includes any type of gambling. The situation would be, though, is that you would have to be 19 years of age or older. That's the only
is a defendant to be in the coverage of the statute. It also requires that you essentially know the person is under 18. So it would be covered if you were over 19 and you knew the person is under 18. It would be. Drafted now, I believe it would. We could draft it so that you could allow social gambling in the situation. We have defined, the way we've done it is we said gambling, and gambling includes any type of gambling. The situation would be, though, is that you would have to be 19 years of age or older. That's the only, is a defendant to be in the coverage of the statute. It also requires that you essentially know the person is under 18. So it would be covered if you were over 19 and you knew the person was under 18. It would be.
Case opposed in item number 3, the sale of a drug takes place on a street corner. A child under 18 years of age is hanging out on the street corner where he has every right to be.
The intent of that section was to, by saying place, was probably to limit it to a situation where it was a four-wall type place. We could redefine it.
Say structure. Okay,
say
like that.
Building, I think might be a better term. We use the term building in the code throughout.
Why don't you do that? Because
that would cover, wouldn't cover the underpass.
Well, the kid might be out at the beach, you know.
Yeah, I read it.
Certainly has a right to be there.
Is the 19 year old limitation acceptable? I mean, this was raised by the police, I believe. That is correct. In other words, requiring the defendant to be 19 years of age or older.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea.
If that had been in there, my son would never reckon.
That keeps it, by the way, consistent with the provisions that under Title IV and the regulations adopted there with respect to liquor.
Yeah.
Furnishing of liquor.
That's the same then. Fine.
The next statute is entitled Unlawful Marrying, and it's an A misdemeanor. This gets at conduct what is commonly thought of as bigamy. It's one of the more, I think, amusing statutes in the code, simply because I think the subcommission got a little carried away in trying to cover all types of conduct here. But it covers not only having more than one wife or husband, acting knowingly. It also covers a situation where you marry more than one person simultaneously, and it also covers a situation where
you're picking on the Mormons, and here the boys are out knocking a door today.
Well,
we got they come through every year, and they'll clean cut young men. Oh, no, I'm afraid the Mormons don't.
But it does get at both parties, as long as they act knowingly.
Yeah, like the girl there in Vietnam that married four guys or something. Some wouldn't come back and she'd show a profit on the insurance.
I told my first wife one time that if I had several wives, she'd be my favorite wife. And she said, that's business. And I said, that's good. That's good.
Diana has to marry. Bible, like, has to marry four times across the country as he moves across. The only thing that they found out later, he had to wait for his wife to die when he got known.
block was void. There never was, even though it did take place. So a second marriage is better than worse than it was.
And Senator, the statute tries to address itself to that question by saying marries are purports to marry. And
right.
That, in the model penal code, that's exactly the example they gave where the marriage was void previously.
What does that mean?
He thinks he's marrying, but it really isn't a second marriage because the other one never was valid to begin with for exactly the situation that I think Senator Ziegler gave.
Quite possibly a more appropriate penalty would be to make all the marriages valid.
The old senator from Arizona before Goldwater was fired.
Oh, yeah.
Carl Hayden, he talked about when he was sheriff and they passed the statute.
Anti-Mormon statute.
That anti-Mormon statute, and some busybody in town, he says, reported this old Hopite chief that had an old wife and a young wife, and he was sent out to enforce it. He says there was the chief sitting under a shade of a tree, and the two women were out hoeing in the squash patch. So he caught it out of his heels there and explained to the chief. But it took a little while for it to get through his head, and he finally said, "You mean I can only have one wife?" And he said, "That's what the law says. That means I have to get rid of one." And he says, "Yes." And so the old chief yelled, and the two women came waddling in. And he says, "You tell him." And Carl says he walked over to the horn and climbed on and left. And that was the end of that.
Don't know.
Could you give us a little more detail? Reminds me of my father told me once. Any guy that marries a second time doesn't deserve to be rid of his first wife.
Speaking of, I think we've gotten to a good friend of mine for the discussion of prostitution.
All right, let's fire into the prostitution. What happened to bribery?
Senator, I just for purposes of, I guess, somewhat of variety, I did not go in the exact order of things appearing in the bill.
Where are we? Where's prostitution?
Page 65.
65?
Yes.
Just for variety?
Yeah. I thought that we would get this really done in one day with all those terrible theft crimes before, so.
All right.
Save this for the end.
Page 65, line 26, strike, section 2.
Let me just for purposes of.
Strike what?
Just for purposes of what the subcommission did.
The matter.
To change existing laws that, okay, number one, they said that a male could be a prostitute.
Oh,
okay. And number two, they said that the patron is just as guilty as the prostitute.
Bullshit.
I'm not gonna.
Who said that?
This draft says that if you engage in prostitution as a patron, you are guilty of prostitution. It also says that if you request someone to engage in prostitution, you're guilty of solicitation, which could be a maximum of 1 year in jail.
I won't buy it.
I'm not going to argue.
No. It's the one that offers to sell, male or female, that you cover. Nobody else.
That would be 90 days in jail.
The B misdemeanor would be 90 days. The situation, though, is that if it's a solicitation in a public place under Section 110, it would be an A misdemeanor, and that would be 1 year.
What you mean if I'm sitting up in the crow's nest or whatever that place is, and I turn to a good-looking dolly and say, I've got about an hour or whatever to spare. How about it? You need 1 year.
But you say, Senator, the draft says that if you say, I will give you money for that, it is a year. That's what the draft says.
If you promised her an hour, that'd be the biggest lie I ever heard of, and it should be for anybody.
She should give me $100. What the hell?
if you make the determination that it should not include the patron, it could be very easily taken care of.
All right, it shall not include the patron. It right. shall include both sexes, so the to cover your male prostitutes, but that's yeah, but I'm just not gonna have, I can see some police broad setting guys up, just, you know, it'd just be a cinch.
You're a congressman from Alaska, not Utah.
Okay. Yeah. So I think I should point out that there could still be a process, even if you knocked out the solicitation for purposes of prostitution section, you could still have a prosecution under the general solicitation statute. It would be a little more difficult to prove, and it would only be a big misdemeanor.
I can't understand bearing down the rush of the thinking of the House to make the actual doing of the act less reprehensible than merely asking somebody to do the act.
Well, the reason being, I guess, was the aggravating factor of it being done in a public place, and it was trying to get at it.
The guy that propositions all the girls in the bar, and I can't remember that, you know, when you were an RA.
You'll be Senator Coletta, John. You'll be Senator Coletta, you're working on this.
I'm not, you know, only the one who offers to do the job for money, the recipient, should be chargeable under this statute. Nobody else.
Page 65 of the
very bottom thereof.
Mr. Hickey, no problem?
Well, I'm just trying to
think how to work
it through.
In other words, the proposition is not illegal. If you're the payee, but it is if you are the recipient.
Yeah. If you're the payee. If you're the payee, it's illegal. If you're the payor, it's all right to solicit.
Yeah. That gives you a little trouble in the madam, so you may have to make sure it doesn't cover the madam that says, hey, Dolly, we can, you know. We're at the C-note for an evening's work tonight.
Yeah, I see an obvious equal protection question there.
What do you mean obvious equal protection?
Well, you're putting the payee into a status, okay, and punishing the payee for the same act as what the payor might engage in, simply because
The one that receives the money is the one that has committed the crime.
Yeah. Well, I think, Clem, I think Dan raises a good point. I think if you knock out 110 solicitation for purposes of prostitution, includes the first section, subsection A, as written, certainly provides an ideal compromise. In other words, two-edged sword under...
For hire.
That's right.
All right, okay, and strikes out number two.
Well, delete section 110, because I agree with you on the solicitation. God almighty, I don't see why you should go to jail for a year for asking somebody to do it. Go to jail for 90 days for doing it.
If you did that, though, it would still say that the male who did engage in prostitution, I mean, with engaged in sex with a prostitute, would be guilty under 110.
Under Class B, Mr.
That's correct.
And but you eliminate any potential constitutional problem.
Well, I don't.
If I just read what Dan just said.
Yeah, I'm not too sure that, you know, I necessarily agree that there would be a constitutional problem.
I don't believe there's a constitutional problem. But if they raid the whorehouse, by God, they don't arrest anybody but the hooker.
Well,
then you better have to agree with what I just been saying.
Right. Yeah. Right. Because if we could do it a number of ways. We could simply apply, we could keep 100 as it is, and we could say 110 only applies to the prostitute. In other words, the conduct that we're going to be getting at is, number one, a person engaging in prostitution as a prostitute and as a patron. Number two, the prostitute who solicits on, in a public place. But we would not get, under that proposal, the patron who solicited a prostitute in a public place.
Well, I don't want you to, and I don't want, page 26, hires a person to engage in sexual conduct. That's fine. Page 65, line 26.
What clauses is advocating you knock out subsection 2 or subsection A?
Or make it pertain to a party who solicits for a third party anyway.
Well, we have that covered separately as another
okay.
offense.
Okay.
That's right. Yeah, one to 110.
If I might, Mr. Chairman.
Yes,
it seems to me that given the fact that the solicitation statute is restricted to in a public place, that the prostitute who accosts an individual in one of those, in a, whatever a public place could be, on the street, in a restaurant, what have you, is no more offensive than an individual who accosts someone who's not a prostitute and offers them $100
right.
to engage in that. And that as a matter of public policy, equal protection questions aside, that it strikes me that there's something inappropriate about singling out the payee as opposed to the payor in that kind of situation.
Well, the only thing I see is set up with police that's just so easy for entrapment. I just don't like, you know, the pipeline worker in the bar, and it's just so easy to set up a case here. And I just don't want to be able to bust it. Now, I can see the troublemaker going down the bar propositioning every gal in the bar, you know. You can figure some way to bust him. That's fine. But after somebody gave you a come, but after somebody gave you a come on and you say, okay, you know, or not okay, it hasn't been a real offer, just a real, and you working tonight, honey? And, well, I might be interested. With 50 due, and here come the handcuffs. And bullshit.
There's probably no reason why that concept couldn't be built into it as an expression of the basically the legislative intent.
I just don't want the police to be able to bust people as they do in a lot of states. You know, I just don't want them to be able to in this state.
Well, what about the reverse? The undercover mail officer who puts himself in situations
to pick up queers.
Or just the undercover male officer who makes it appear to a prostitute that he's someone who's ready, willing, able, and very eager.
I don't have any objection to that. She has to make the offer.
Why don't you boys go back to the drawing board office and pass over it now? Because obviously we've got a problem.
Yeah, well, I think
we've
got the understanding.
I think we've
yeah.
got a fairly good concept.
Yeah. No, I don't mind. I don't mind the cop, male or female.
Okay.
Robert,
next then. Have you got something else on this?
Well, should I do the remaining statutes in the prostitution section, or do you want to skip over?
We can cover those if you want them. Just that one.
Yeah, fairly. Yeah, the promoting prostitution on page 66 is trying to get at the situation of the pimp or the madam. Who, with intent to promote prostitution, does one of four acts, covers, you know, running a house, a place of prostitution, or prostitution enterprise, causing a person to engage in prostitution, living basically off the earnings of prostitution.
Covers the pimping, too.
Yeah, it's a C felony. Compelling prostitution is a B felony, it's the most serious offense here. And deals with the situation where you're forcing someone to engage in prostitution. You're engaging in you're causing someone under 16 years of age to engage in prostitution, or you're causing someone in your legal custody to engage in prostitution.
Don't you see why running a whorehouse under 120 ought to be a Class C felony, for God's sake? I would go for maybe a Class A misdemeanor, but...
No, the second one, the compelling prostitution.
I don't care about that so much. I feel fine and dandy, but I don't think that just maintaining a whorehouse I don't think it merits a Class C felony.
Senator, did you feel that way about all the subsections in that statute?
Mm. All except this compelling prostitution.
He's
talking about 120, 123,
and 4. Okay, 123, and 4.
Yeah, I think Class A misdemeanor. I can't think of any madam in this state who's ever been convicted who ever did more than a few months at that. Generally, they pay a nominal fine, and now you've got them in a Class C felony.
Yeah, I tend to agree with him that making the operating of a house of ill repute just a little bit more serious.
Okay, in Alaska, we're going to make it a felony, and certain parts of Nevada is encouraged and wide open by law. Now, what the hell?
County Board of Costs. I'd have a local option in this state if I could get it through.
Under existing law, most of these offenses, I think, could be punishable as felonies. So we would be reducing the penalties somewhat. Just a point of information.
Well, I tend to agree with him, unless you think it's going to cause real problems down the line somewhere.
Compelling.
The thing is that at best prostitution, if there's no rolling, no underage, no force involved, should be at best a misdemeanor.
That's,
it's not a serious crime, God Almighty, can it?
I'm not going to argue with that. It almost, by one vote in the subcommission decided whether they were going to even make prostitution a crime to begin with.
You can't wipe it out because the house would go bananas over it. Other than that, I'd say offhand that Senator Ziegler is absolutely right on track there with a Class A misdemeanor is the maximum for a madam.
I guess the point I would make is that to the extent that Section 120 covers that, I think Senator Ziegler is absolutely correct. But it includes a number of things that under existing law are felonies. Basically, what's covered here in terms of present day practices in the trade, in prostitution. Or pimps. And the concept of
Wouldn't you get the pimp under 140?
Well, you do in the isolated circumstances set out in it.
Yes, it's pretty isolated.
But the usual case where a pimp is going to be involved is going to be 120. And that under present law, I believe, is a felony. It's relatively serious.
Why don't you break it down to accomplish my desires? I mean, I don't care if you want to take 1, 2, 3, and 4 and reclassify them somehow. I would have no objections, but just operating a body house.
Yeah, number one is the only one then that you really care about.
Well, there's some conduct there that maybe not as,
Well, the person who owns, controls, manages, supervises, or otherwise maintains a place of prostitution, that pretty well covers your madam without letting off your pimp. In other words, if number one was a Class A misdemeanor, number 2 and 3 remained as a felony.
Well, except for the madam also derives her income.
She does, but the thing is that if she sent out call girls, you could bust her under 2 and 3. If she operated the massage parlor, you couldn't.
No, what I'm saying is that you'd get them at them that way.
Yeah, you could get them at them that way, but I think that anybody, if you made that change, you know, here, where you had those two sections, it is pretty hard to convict the madam unless she sent gals out on call. In other words, if she operated but if the customers actually came to the massage parlor, fine, that's a class A misdemeanor.
Okay, so you're really talking about where a person, you're dealing with a place of prostitution as opposed to maybe the pimp or walking on the streets.
Yeah, where he ships the gal out, because that's where your pimps make it. You know, there's not much room for the pimps at a massage parlor or a regular cat house. You know,
it's going to be somewhat difficult, but we'll give it a try. And yeah, we'll take a look.
Okay.
You
can tell I was the old water boy at Fairbanks. Panama Hattie ran the line.
The compelling statute.
I know a girl so dumb when she thought that Peter Pan was a wash basin in the world.
That's the one they told me in Fairbanks years ago.
compelling statute is a beef felony, and I.
That's no case.
The other two sections here deal with corroboration under the promoting statute, a compelling statute, and whether a spouse could be a witness. And they.
If a pimp marries her, you can't use her as a witness.
Well, it says that's not true. This section says it is a, that you can testify.
Yeah, but I got it tomorrow.
What's your marriage, is that?
Yeah, right. Spouse's witness, strike.
Well, it was. I think you would, Dan, I think you suggested that this didn't belong here and probably should be just left to court rule in terms of whether force was used.
I think I once did. I don't recall. So
I know specifically Ann suggested this probably doesn't dealt with court rule.
All right, lines 9 through 11, delete. Well, after all, she has every right to leave it, and then she's covered under the other statute.
Well, the point I think the section makes, and it's been a long time since I've thought about it, that in this state, the spousal privilege, the evidentiary privilege, goes to the defendant's spouse. So, in other words, if the acts or conduct which were the subject of a case took place during the time of the marriage, the defendant's spouse could assert the privilege. It's not the witness.
I don't want a husband or wife testifying against each other.
Well, there's the reason I said by court rule is there is a section in the rules that says that if force was used, in other words, the
that's fine.
Yeah,
take care of it.
And that's how the answer suggested, as a matter of fact.
Okay. Can recess before the end. Are we ready for a recess?
I'm ready anytime you are.
Take a break. Well, you know, if you think some of these are causing problems, I really object to anything in the prostitute. You know, I don't believe
it's
going
to be
a crime.
It's going to be difficult to work on a little truck.
Yeah. But we can't quite go that far yet. We will before many years.
Peter will never recognize it.
Huh?
After you get through with it. Yeah. See, there's no way.
Existing court rule can take care of
when the statute of protection
right.
of a person or a member of the class of people, then intersubstantial immunity doesn't apply.
This section, I think, would have the effect of changing the court rule.
The Westford. So what? God, it used to be in the Westward Hotel if you, if they had a tie-in, because when you got a room, you'd get a telephone call, and they knew when you were there.
How long ago was
this? Four or five years ago.
Before the natives took over. They've been criticized for not knowing how to conduct business.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what, they've got a, they did clean it up. They made it a family hotel pretty much.
Yes. Call meeting back to order. Page 67, gambling expenses.
Gambling, well, we have, there are two major changes to existing law and gambling statutes. Number one, we exempted the friendly social game from the coverage of gambling, the gambling prohibition. And additionally, we have given felony penalties for promoting or profiting from an unlawful gambling enterprise.
No, I mean when you go around and recruit the gang.
those are the two major changes in the bill. We have the offense of gambling, which is defined as engaging in unlawful gambling, and that would include all forms of gambling. We have an affirmative defense to that if you were a player in a social game. That requires that you only play, you only participate in gambling as a contestant or bettor, with only receiving personal gambling winnings without cheating and not being a professional gambler. That term professional gambler, in terms of the person deriving their livelihood from the gambling, was added by the House Judiciary Committee.
We will achieve justice. The Attorney General heard about this.
Well, I see from Dan's recommendation that the Attorney General does not particularly like that requirement. Social game, and social game is defined as gambling a home where there are no house odds or house income. Now, the penalty for gambling is a violation for the first offense, which would be maximum $300 fine. For second and subsequent offenses, it would be a B misdemeanor. The effect of this, of course, is that if you're in an after-hours gambling establishment and it's raided, you as a player would only be subject to a $300 fine for the first offense and a penis meet for the second subsequent offense. Now, subsection 210 and 220 is promoting gambling in the first and second degree. The first degree provision is defined as promoting or profiting from an unlawful gambling enterprise. And a gambling enterprise is defined on page 70 of the bill as five or more persons who conduct a gambling business which remains in substantial continuous operation for 30 days or has $2,000 in gross income in any single day. That definition was taken directly from the federal gambling statute. I don't have a specific site right now, but it's taken directly from the federal gambling statute. And if you just promote unlawful gambling, and it's not necessarily a gambling enterprise, it would be an A misdemeanor. Now, section 230 and section 240 are the possession of gambling records offenses, and they parallel the first and second degrees.
That's the bookmaker stuff.
Well, the bookmaker, it would also include the situation where you might not necessarily be able to prove specifically that five or more persons were involved through the raid, but you could prove it through the books of the company, and it would get perhaps the accountant, it would get anyone in possession of those records, so long as you could prove that the person had knowledge of the contents of the records. We have a statute on possession of gambling devices, which makes it an A misdemeanor to possess a gambling device with reckless disregard that it will be used in unlawful gambling, and there's a defense to that, an affirmative defense that you are only intending to use it in a social game. So slot machines, for example, would not be covered by that section. Then section 270 of the bill provides for forfeiture of gambling devices as well as money that's seized in a gambling raid, essentially. Those are the sections. I know the Department of Law has a couple of suggestions on this.
I've got a question I want to give you.
Okay.
Let's say, what would you read, John, when over there on the wall, and the five of us at the table, you know, been acquaintances, and we gather occasionally, periodically, over the course of the years, we have brought our own, hypothetically, our own table, our own chips, time to time, we buy our own cards, the right let us say, more than $2,000, cash box is kept by a volunteer, but it's full of gambling records such as checks and IOUs. There's a rake-off where one guy, let's say, buys booze and arranges for sandwiches and beer. Cops walk in at 11 o'clock. What happens?
Well, first I have to, where are you conducting this game?
In a private room. In my apartment, let us say. Or yours.
The code says that you will not have committed any offense, and the reason I come to that conclusion is that you will not have committed promoting or profiting from an unlawful gambling enterprise, even though
you're the organizer, and you go around and put a little check sheet and say, are you going to be there tonight, Mr. Havlin? Are you going to judge?
Yeah, you still would not be covered. The reason being is that
You don't take house off.
Yeah, and there's a number of reasons, but as it's drafted out, if you could show that you engaged in it as a livelihood, or you derived at least 20% of your income from gambling, it would be covered. But I think that issue is separate. I think that issue could be considered separate.
What about the American Legion? It sends out a notice to all its members. Have a stag night.
Yes.
On Monday night, and there will be fun and games, referring both to poker 4, 5, 6, as well as to a stripper or whatever the case might be. I'm obviously doing this for a profit. It's a one-shot thing. There'll be more than $2,000 involved.
Yes, I think that would, Senator, that would be covered because it is not taking place in the home. Now the subcommittee considered whether that should be expanded to include private clubs or various other types of private activities that do not take place at home, and they felt that it should not. So that would be
no more than existing law.
Yeah.
I mean, it's carried on. We all know that all over the state from time to time, but it is illegal. But it is illegal.
The only difference would be is that under existing law would not be a felony.
So why is it under this?
It was under this because the subcommission felt that instances of gambling enterprises exist in Alaska that did not fit into the category of the American Legion. There are some instances where you would want to have felony prosecution.
There's no way that a differentiation can be made, because I don't think that the people who are running the Elks or the Moose or the Eagles or the VFW or the American Legion ought to be convicted felons.
Yes, I think we could. I think we could, as long as the differentiation said you're not guilty of a felony, you're guilty of a misdemeanor.
Yeah, well, how about busting it down the house? Nobody's going to run a regular gambling house without taking odds. If you stick to McDonald's Book of Odds, you're not going to make a profit.
Well, I think you have to make the decision if whether you want the criminal code to allow gambling to occur outside the home. If you decide that it shouldn't, then we can make the decision that perhaps it shouldn't be a felony, but it occurs in a private club, it should only be a misdemeanor. And that would be consistent with existing law.
What are the problems from your standpoint? Did you have some suggestions?
I had a few suggestions. I don't know that the ones that I had will resolve all of the issues that have been raised. But most of the questions I raised, with the
exception of the definition of the player, are those that have been brought to our attention by the law enforcement community, specifically the Department of Public Safety, the Chiefs of Police Association, and the Alaska Peace Officers Association. They feel, and they testified on two or three different occasions before the subcommission, they feel very strongly about these gambling offenses and certain provisions that are in them, some of which, as I understand it, they agree with wholeheartedly. On page 68, the offense of possession of gambling weapons in the first and second degree is set out. If you then turn to the definitions, page 70, you'll see that gambling device is defined, but gambling records aren't. And gambling device is defined in a way to exclude lottery tickets, policy slips, or other items used in playing basis lottery policy schemes. Now, as I understand it, discussing with Barry, it was the intent of the bill that these were excluded from gambling device because they would be included under gambling records. And I think that's fine, but I think it needs to be made clear that either a definition should be included in the definition section or in the basic definition of gambling records in the offense section itself, making it clear that lottery tickets, policy slips, et cetera, are covered in that way. And this is something, again, that the police raised. They thought it very strange that these things were excluded.
Well,
because that they're really, particularly when you're talking about policy slips, they're evidence of a large-scale gambling operation that's very lucrative, the numbers racket.
Yeah, that's what they are. Didn't want to cover bingo.
Well, the situation...
Well, what are policy slips?
That's going to be... I thought they were with the numbers.
The numbers?
Yeah.
It's a... Basically, I don't know how, I don't know what it is in Alaska, and I assume it's the same way, but it's a, basically run out of New York, and it's a thing with, stock quotations. And, you
might
pick numbers. You pick numbers, the last three numbers or something, it's a sequence of numbers, and there's an astronomical mathematical probability about these three numbers all falling together in one place at one time. People apparently play them day after day after day.
Play the numbers. Play 25 cents, and you check your three numbers, 362. 362 comes in, you get the jackpot. Otherwise, you're done.
I think I understand the game, but the other one, the policy,
that's what they call them.
I mean, that's the thing that you determine, you make them select.
When your bookie comes by and you make your slip, he writes his down. An initial, and give sells you that number, and you pay so much for that number.
And the bingo card is could be classified as a policy slip.
I would read that as another item used.
Well, if it's in there.
Well,
it gets close. Then,
yeah, the situation was, and I agree completely with. Well, Dan and I discussed this, and there's an offense of possession of gambling devices, and there's a. The offense of possession of gambling records, and this provides that certain items used in the playing phases of a lottery or policy schemes are not gambling devices. The intent is, of course, that gambling records, and the fact that we excluded it from one definition but not included in the other apparently made the police think that we were trying to exclude it altogether. We weren't. We could be more specific.
Well, if you want to be more specific, but we don't want somebody raiding the A and B hall after this thing passes.
Well,
what do they do? $250,000 worth of business. They're a big gambling
I'm sorry, what do you mean A and B hall?
The Alaska Native Brotherhood.
About four blocks from here.
Yeah.
Several nights a week.
And they run through a quarter to a half a
yes,
million
dollars. Yes, but that's
lawful.
That's bingo pursuant to the statute, isn't that correct? Because we exclude, you see, the code only prohibits unlawful gambling, and unlawful says not specifically authorized by law, and that would include the subtitle six.
You're right.
So, but this, I really see this one is just a technical one we're dealing with.
How would you do that?
Well, we would say either in the definition of gambling device, where it says page 70, we could say on line 18 or 19, lottery tickets, policy slips, or other items, etc., and then say such items are considered gambling records, or we could define gambling records as including lottery tickets, policy slips, or other items. We'll have to work it out, but.
Yeah.